All right, our next presenter is Dr. Meredith Binkler from the University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health.
Okay, thank you. I have nothing to declare except that I'm very jazzed to be here with this great panel, and I am sorry that my colleague Dr. Moraes cannot be with us as well, but Cape Town is a long flight. I just wanted to start by saying that although we're giving you contemporary examples of community-engaged research, the deepest roots of this tradition, as many of you know, go back to places like Latin America, Brazil in particular with Paulo Freire, Tanzania, India. So we need to respect and certainly convey to communities that this is a tradition that comes from us, not from them and not from us. I put in a simple definition of community-based participatory research for those not familiar with it, and I did circle affecting change. To me, that's not an either-or. That has to be a requirement of doing this kind of work. And I also put a slide in on the continuum of engagement. This comes from Rachel Morales Frosch, and I know that this Rachel is going to talk a little bit more about that. So I'm going to move right along to my topic, which was how does community engagement add value to research and action in low-resource countries? My very first example comes from the colleague you just heard from. Dr. Mosaval has written one of the classic pieces in CBPR about an early study she did where she wanted to look at cervical cancer, which is a huge project and problem in South Africa, very high rates, but knew that this was not high on the agenda of South African women. And so she convened a community advisory board, and they said, if you change the term and call it cervical health, then you can also allow us to look at things like HIV/AIDS, STDs, sexual violence, lots of other social problems. So, you know, it was a brilliant thing to do, an important strategy, and I don't think she would have been able to do her work without making that change. Well, you all know and have heard already that partnering with communities can improve the cultural sensitivity, the reliability, and validity of our survey and other measurement tools. And I just wanted to, many of you I'm sure know Spanish, in that language there is still, I believe, no word for empowerment. This project was done some years ago in Guatemala, and the outside researcher had community members try to come up with a concept, with a term that they could use, and they couldn't. They said that, you know, most of the terms that have power in them refer to power over, not power with or power to. And parts of some of these terms like strengthening or fortified, self-generated, self-determination had something to say about empowerment, but they made the important point that in Latin America, empowerment can only represent group effort because the individual can't change things by him or herself. And fast forward a couple of decades, the Voces y Manos project going on now in Guatemala ran into the same problem. This was a survey to look at students' assessment of empowerment, and the students looked at the pre-existing measures, didn't like them at all, tried to develop a survey that would be more culturally relevant, and look at their wording of that one question. I believe I am capable of proposing a solution to a problem at a community assembly. It's all individual within the context of larger group and community. Well, we just heard about the nightmare of doing human subjects overseas. Imagine doing it in a country like Tibet, where, among other things, maternal mortality rates are among the highest in the world. There is no written language. The traditional midwives were very helpful in helping the outside researchers figure out how to convey what they needed to about informed consent, pointing out, for example, that there are cultural problems with disclosing risk because it disturbs the wind elements responsible for emotions. So talk about safety, but never use that word risks. Similarly, you want to explain randomization? Talk about the lottery system for dividing up the meat from large animals that are killed on a hunt. Nothing that the researchers would have known to do without their help. Well, CBPR also, of course, can greatly increase the relevance of our interventions and thus the likelihood of success. And I wanted to share with you one of my favorite examples, which comes from Dr. Chirawodza and his team in South Africa. This is a Project Accept is a HIV randomized controlled trial comparing traditional community, you know, voluntary counseling and testing with a more community-based approach. And I was very impressed with the way that the team went about this. For example, look at number two in their pre-intervention phase. Understand how community members describe their communities, both geographically and socially. So he and his colleagues did desk review. They used GIS and census mapping to define possible study communities, but they also wanted to find out what the communities define as their communities and where is there a sense of shared practice and shared identity. This is a couple of pictures he sent me that just blew me away, because you can see how low resource the situation is in which they were working. In some of the communities, they were literally using sticks and stones and leaves, sometimes magic markers, to indicate where, you know, what the considerations were about the community that needed to be taken into account. This other one uses Post-its, which I think are the new cockroaches. They're just everywhere. But anyway, then they got together. They transferred all the information they had learned through the mapping onto charts, so they would have study records of the different community insights they had gained. And then they went in teams to do these transect walks. And during the walks, they would confirm issues that were brought up during the mapping. They would confirm the existence, the location of the existing VCTs. And they also were on the lookout for things like natural boundaries, natural barriers, buffers that might separate a potential intervention community from a control community, and which were very helpful to the researchers wanting to do a good study and not have a lot of contamination. So all of this information they gathered was just terrific. They also found a lot of fixed and mobile VCTs already available, and they found that there was almost no correspondence between what communities called themselves and the census name for those communities. So by going in and using the names the communities used, the outsider partners, and these are fellow Africans, but they're, you know, higher level education, they are outsiders, they had a great deal more credibility than had they gone in using a census name. Well, these are just some of the findings, and I would point out to you, number two, particularly important, they found out that many more VCTs existed than anyone expected, and as a result, they were able to do things like train over 250 existing lay counselors and give them rapid testing kits rather than putting in a whole bunch of new sites that actually weren't needed. The research team had a nice reflection on their work, talking about how if they'd only relied on the visualization capacity of GIS, they would have missed all kinds of political, social, cultural, economic values held by the community, and really missed a real image of what those communities were about, what mattered to them. Well, as all of the speakers have indicated, one of the nice side effects, and certainly one of the goals of community-engaged research, is building individual and community partner capacity. And this can happen even when the level of participation is not that high. So this is a project that was done in Guatemala and currently being done in India, a wood stove project to look at the way if adding a chimney will reduce the very high exposure to fine particulate matter for women and their families in this community. And my colleague Kurt Smith talks about kitchens in these communities as being toxic waste factories, because they convert so much of the energy into toxic substances. These are all the diseases for which we have at least some epidemiological evidence that there is a relationship between the indoor air pollution from stoves and disease outcomes. The Guatemala project is now finished, and as you can see here, there was a 91% reduction in PM 2.5 fine particulate matter in the open air fire household stoves versus those with the chimney. So that was a very exciting thing. But they didn't at that time measure outcomes in the field workers. And a former student of mine went back recently to Guatemala and did a study with them and found that they talked about gaining confianza, not only the confidence of the women with whom they interacted, but great self-confidence for themselves. Their health knowledge, which she studied through a before-after test, really increased through this process, their ability to speak in public. They talked about women coming to ask them for advice, improved organizational skills, which meant not only remembering to carry your notebook and your pen, but also the stick for the aggressive stray dogs, and being motivated to seek additional training. Well, let me move quickly to facilitating dissemination and use of study findings. And we all need and know the value of publishing, not just for tenure, but also for spreading what we learn to other communities. On the other hand, if we stop there, we are not doing the full job. And these are two quick examples of creative dissemination of findings. This one in Gujarat, where there were 400 residents, very few jobs. So the men are away all week. They come back on the weekend, often bringing HIV with them. Well, the community partners on this study remembered that years ago, when family planning was kind of a new concept, 15 local credit and loan associations had been willing to convey family planning information to women. So they enlisted their help again, and they were able to have a very positive dissemination mechanism. They also recruited youth at street fairs to participate in gender-specific plays about HIV and condoms that I would not have imagined could have happened. In the Liberian civil conflict, horrendous, as you know, violence, rape of women, published articles coming out in places like Lancet and JAMA, but meanwhile, the researchers and the full team also did a manual for training midwives. They did radio plays in local languages. They got YouTube videos up. They did a report and a multimedia piece for the Truth Commission, and I would argue all of those probably did more good than the JAMA article that not too many people may have read or done anything with. Okay, finally, increasing the potential for translating evidence-based research into sustainable change, ideally on the policy level. This is one of the most dramatic cases I know of. Northern Nigeria, one in six countries that account for nearly half of the maternal mortality in the world, and a quarter of it from postpartum depression. Would that it were that. It's postpartum hemorrhage. This is a country where you cannot have high-level community engagement. It is not allowed because of the hierarchical model and the strict gender lines. And so they worked with traditional birth attendants, with some community outreach workers, some drug keepers who literally kept the misoprostol, the drug, to help prevent postpartum hemorrhage, and they enrolled quite a few women in this study. And this is a collaboration between Ahmadu Bello University and our Bixby Center at the School of Public Health at Berkeley. The community contributions were things like this, saying, okay, you want to educate women about postpartum hemorrhage, show them the Moda. That's the little measuring cup that they use commonly for water, and that holds about as much blood as would constitute postpartum hemorrhage. Use the yalo, a local fruit, and some balloons to show the normal and contracting uterus. So they made the education more real. They also talked about culturally appropriate items for advertising miso use. And finally, just in terms of outcomes, the big take home is that of the 1,800 women who delivered at home, over 1,700 delivered with the traditional birth attendants. Over 1,400 took miso prophylactically, and there were only 16 cases of postpartum hemorrhage and only one death. A remarkable change, and one that they then brought to the policy table. Nigeria became the first country with national guidelines about the use of miso, community-based distribution to prevent postpartum hemorrhage, and they got the World Health Organization to put miso on the essential medicine list. So I was going to, this is a nice paper in Social Science and Medicine, by the way, if you want to read more about this project. Prada is the first author. But anyway, the point was that even when there's modest levels of community participation, you can really see change. Okay, I was going to talk a tiny bit about community mapping, which I'm not going to have time to do, but Rachel knows a great deal more about it than I do, so I'm going to turn it over to her, but I have to leave you with a line from Dr. Moraes about how important he feels community-engaged research is in his country, in his Western Cape Town, where he works. And then also a line that I think also echoes my colleague and hero, Dr. Mosaval, this Fulfudi saying, patients can cook a stone. I really think has to be our touchstone as we do this work, particularly in a global context. Thank you. Thank you.